Welcome back to another episode of the Stephen Reed podcast. On today's episode, we have Laura Young, and we talk about mental illness and what it's like to be part of a deaf school. I hope you enjoy.
Stephen Reed.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. It's nice to have you here. It seems like I've seen quite a lot of you recently.
Yeah.
Considering over the last couple of years, I've not really seen much, but actually I've got to know you quite a bit better over the last sort of, I'd say, 6 months or so.
Yeah.
Probably since we went on holiday together.
Yeah. We got to know each other quite well then.
Yeah.
That was nice.
We all got to know everyone quite well then. Which was nice. Is
that
that's what
like we had an orgy.
We didn't quite have an orgy. Again, that kind of sounds like we might have nearly had an orgy. Yeah, we didn't.
No, we didn't.
Not even close. Although we did have a picture where we all had no clothes on.
Yeah.
That was the closest we came.
We didn't touch each other, though.
No one saw or anything.
No.
So yeah, that was our holiday. Just to give a little bit of a background about you, I'm going to ask for you to fill in all the gaps because there's going to be loads, but you're a friend from school. We sort of grew up together in the same town and we kind of similar friendship group. And then over the last couple of years, we've sort of got to spend a bit more time with each other, just socialising and things. And then we all went off to uni and you worked here as a dental nurse, is that right? And then somehow you're going to have to fill in these gaps because somehow you've gone from being a dental nurse to working in a school, in a deaf school, right?
I didn't like nursing, so I became a head receptionist and then started
at
the same practice.
Okay.
And then started applying to uni again because I deferred my first offer to be, and I got into Southampton for social work.
Was that what your first, what you were planning to do first of all?
Yeah, that's what I applied for in sixth form. And then, yeah, I started applying to do counselling and things like that. But I saw the job at Mary Hare and I'd my sister's best friend's profoundly deaf. So I've always been interested in it. In deafness and stuff, and I volunteered at Castle School quite a bit, so I knew I liked schools, and then I got the job.
So that's not a deaf school, the Castle School.
No, that's okay. For children with special needs.
Okay, so it seems like you've always wanted to work around people in some regard, then. And what is it that interests you in the in deafness in general?
I think. Because I like English language, which is what I'm doing at uni now, I think it's just so interesting how deaf people are able to communicate with each other and with other people and pick up all the knowledge that they have and keep up to their hearing, like the hearing peers that they have. And you don't even notice how hard they actually have to work until you start looking into it and studying hearing impairments. And I think it's just like crazy how almost inspirational they all are without even noticing it. It's just like life to them.
Yeah, I was amazed actually when we went on holiday and it was the first time I'd spent a long time around you where I realised actually how much you did know about sign language and what it takes to be deaf. And we actually met someone who was deaf out there, and he gave us all sign names, which was pretty special.
We
met him completely by chance, didn't we, in a nightclub. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
it was awesome. And then I was fascinated by the fact that you can have different languages in sign.
Yeah,
because that was definitely a misconception I had, that there was just one, it was sign language, there was like one thing.
No, so in the UK there's like BSL and different sign languages.
So that's British Sign Language,
which is the most commonly used one. But then
in the world?
In the UK.
Okay.
And then there's American Sign Language, which is different because they tend to use only one hand when they sign. So their whole alphabet is done with one hand, whereas British Sign Language is done with both of your hands. But then in British Sign Language, I didn't notice this until I started working at Mary Hare. But obviously, because I learned some sign up north in Northumberland, there's accents in sign. So I learned numbers 1 to 10 up north in sign, and they are completely different down here. So, like,
that
even counting. Yeah, counting. I once got in a bit of a sticky situation trying to, like, signing to one of the students, have a good holiday, because holiday up north is where you put your middle finger up on both hands and do circles with your hands. But because they mainly use Southern Sign Language, and a lot of them didn't realise that was the sign for holiday, they just thought I was swearing at them. And luckily one of the boys was from, I think he was from Newcastle, so he knew that it was the sign for holiday and backed me up. But it is just crazy how different all the signs are.
It's mad. I can't believe that, yeah, like you say, not only are there different languages, there's different dialects and accents.
Yeah.
And the what's even more mind-blowing is two countries that speak the same language, America and the UK, have completely different languages and sign.
Yeah.
That's so cool, and it's something that, mm-hmm. you know, you'd never yeah. know. So what do you like about working in a school? Because it's not just about being able to sign and things like that. There must be a lot more to teaching.
I think I like... So last year was the year I first started with, because I started as a TA and then became cover supervisor. And they were the year I worked with first, and they left. And obviously you see the effect you're having on their education and their learning and things, but it's not until they actually go into the wide world, big wide world. And then on the last day they were saying how they've got a job interview, and they used things that I'd gone through with them and I'd helped them learn, and then they got the job. In some of the reasons they got the job, the interviewer said, was things that we'd done in, like, life skills lessons or speech and language therapy sessions. And it's just nice seeing that you have such a positive influence on these young people, and I just like that bit.
That's
of it
brilliant.
Really, yeah.
So how did you find the transition between doing your receptionist work and then starting to teach? That's a, in my eyes, is a pretty big jump. It can be sort of further away from each
yeah.
other, really.
Yeah, it was very different. But I think because I'd volunteered in school since I was 16, no, well, probably younger, actually, 15, I knew how the system worked, and I knew what to expect. So I kind of just fell into it, and it was all quite natural and easy.
Okay. So did you go to work in a school because you wanted to do English language anyway? Or has that... Because you're studying that at the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm doing that at uni at the moment. When I was looking to apply to uni again, when I was at the dentist, I was looking more to go down the counselling route. But now I'm in a school, I do think teaching is the route I want to go down. But I also am very interested in the well-being and safeguarding side of school, and especially because we are a boarding school. It's because the students live there and
that
obviously
must
go
add
to school
a whole
there.
Other
yeah.
aspect to that whole category.
Yeah. So obviously our well-being at Mary Hare is amazing, and all the people that are involved in it are really good. And we, like, I went on a mental health first aid course, which was, like, just crazy. It was, like, one of the most intense things I've ever done, but it was so good. And I think just because a lot of our students, obviously, I don't know if this is generalised for all deaf people or if it is just so happens to be Mary Hare, but a lot of our students have extra help with emotional literacy. So kind of knowing that when they feel something, trying to work, pinpoint what that emotion is. So instead of like, if you feel anxious in some, because of they haven't had like incidental learning, they might not have heard the word anxious before. They might never have come across that. So in their head, that's just sad.
So emotional
literacy. Yeah.
But you said also incidental learning. That is, I take it, is just picking things up by hearing them or just being around people talking about that stuff.
Because, yeah, so like a hearing child by the age of 5 is encountered something crazy, like 80% of the words they're ever going to use in their whole life. Even if they can't grasp the understanding or use them correctly or use them at all, they will have heard them at some point, whether that's on TV, on radio, in conversations, like they've been said to them, where obviously a lot of deaf children who are born deaf or become deaf at a young age don't get that. And if they become deaf at a later age, then that just suddenly stops. So although they've already got it, it doesn't get any better. So we have lots of people who will say things like, I feel this way, in where kind of a lot, we do a lot of work on well-being and emotions and things. So kind of showing them that there's sad, but then underneath that umbrella of sad, there's like nervous and anxious and annoyed and frustrated and angry and things like that. It's not just one emotion, for one word for all of those emotions.
So going back to your mental health training then, what was it called, sorry?
Mental health first aid.
Mental health first aid. Because that sounds like something really interesting and something that maybe the general population could benefit from anyway.
Yeah.
And actually listening to you talk about emotional literacy and being able to pinpoint how you're feeling, I can relate to the fact that actually it's not always that while I'm experiencing emotion that I know what emotion it is. It's only on reflection or looking back that I can tell that. And that can't just be me. I'm sure it's actually a lot of people that don't really, you know, it's only when you sit down and reflect on what is it that you're experiencing at that time. And that's only something that I've gotten better at through things like sitting and, you know, practicing mindfulness or meditation. Yeah. So tell me what happened on your mental health first aid course.
It was a 2-day course, and I think every school in the UK is entitled to one free place on it. But our school puts, I think we have 10 places on it each year. So like lots of people are trained on it, including the nurses, ELSA, the Wellbeing Safeguarding Lead. So we have loads of different people from different sectors of the school on it. And it was so 2 days long, and we kind of looked at different mental health problems. So we looked at good mental health, bad mental health, which is normal and obviously everyone gets, and then mental health illness or mental health problems. Mm. And we kind of looked at how to identify if a young person, we obviously did it for secondary school, so it was targeted at older children or teenagers. So we looked at how to kind of identify if they are just having a bad day and their mental health isn't good at that particular day or month, or if it is actually becoming a problem and therefore affecting the way they can carry out things and do things in their day-to-day life, and then where to go with that and how to try and, if it is a mental health problem, then who to talk to about it, or if it is just bad mental health, how we can help and support them through that.
Is there anything you picked up on that you've maybe used outside of the school, either for yourself or for friends, any like just hard and fast techniques or tips that have come out of it?
Like the techniques for like bad mental health, I've definitely used on myself. Like if I've had a bad day, there's been things that I've like learned from there that I've tried to do to kind of cheer myself up or rationalize things. So if I think like if something bad happened and I was in a strop and thought, oh, it's the end of the world. I'd kind of use techniques I'd learned to kind of rationalize those thoughts and be like, this isn't the end of the world. Mm. And with friends and stuff as well, it's kind of, there's been a couple of situations, like one in particular, we got told that it's okay to ask someone if they are thinking of killing themselves. And that really like freaked me out because in my head, I thought, you can't just say to someone, are you going to kill yourselves? Because if the answer is no, what happens if you implant that thought in their head? Mm. And I had like lots of questions about that and stuff, but I have actually been in a situation outside of school where I have had to say to someone, like, are you thinking of hurting yourself or worst case killing yourself? And they kind of like stopped and were like, and it's just things like that and kind of being able to support friends or having normal interactions with people. So like when you can see someone's having a bad day, instead of going in and just being more aware that people have other things going on. So instead of being grumpy that someone hasn't given me the best customer service in a shop, just kind of saying, I hope you have a good day, hope everything's all right, and things like that. Just letting them know that there are people there rather than being grumpy.
Because that's something that I've actually seen a little bit in my field of work as well, because speaking to a GP about it actually fairly recently, about noticing when someone is low in mood, you know, or is just having a bad day, or whether they are genuinely depressed and are suicidal.
Yeah.
And actually, from an outsider and someone who doesn't know an awful lot about mental health and who isn't trained in mental health at all, it's an area that I don't have a lot of experience on, and I don't feel very comfortable talking about it with people. But actually, it is really important from a safeguarding point of view, because, you know, if I hear a patient saying they want to kill themselves, you know, I have to do something about that or act on it. And actually, there's been a couple of occasions where I've had uncomfortable conversations with people who have brought up these phrases, but the GP actually challenged me on it when I talked to them, because I didn't have anyone else to go to, and I needed to speak to them and say, look, you know, the patient that you look after has said this. And they said, well, did you ask them any follow-up questions on it? And that struck me as a strange thing, because I thought before that if someone has said that phrase, I assumed that was because they genuinely meant it. But actually, it's quite hard to articulate, but in the situation I was in, it was more of a fact that my patient was trying to use that as leverage to get out of hospital quicker, essentially, because it was because they were fed up and they didn't want to be there. And they said, well, if you don't let me go home, you know, I'm going to kill myself. And so the GP wasn't concerned, which, you know, that was a bit of a shock to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, you know, have you asked the patient, how are they going to do it? Have they planned what they're going to do? And he said, actually, that is a lot more important in my setting, at least. It's probably completely different in all sorts of different settings, but actually it's not those people who are outwardly outspoken about it and are bragging about it all the time. It's the ones who are really quiet and who are thinking about it and quite, you know, the ones that have actually paid real thought into actually how they're going to do it or have attempted to do it in the past.
Yeah. I think, what I definitely took from the course is anybody who says that obviously needs to be listened to, whether it's at face value because they are going to, or if someone says they're going to kill themselves, even if they have no intention of doing it,
of
saying that obviously isn't showing good mental health. So then there's underlying problems in their needing help for whatever reason. I just think it's, and especially knowing that every school in the UK, including primary, have access to this, and they do a course for people working in offices, because obviously that's very high stress, and they do so many like variations of this course. And I think especially like you say, you've not had any of training on mental health, and it's so important. And I think it's something that needs to be talking about more, because if I, before I'd done the course, if someone had said to me, I want to kill myself, then I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know who to tell. I wouldn't know how to respond. I don't know what I would have done.
Definitely. It's not something that you come across very often in day to day. And I want to make clear as well that when I said, you know, the GP wasn't concerned, or, you know, it's not that that person was then ignored. But
no, it's
was
a tough call to make, though. There's definitely been times, obviously, in the school day where you need to report something, and then someone has to make, the person whose job it is to make that call needs to make it. And whether that's doing something, putting, obviously, there'll always be something in place for the young person to keep them safe. But sometimes you might need to send them home or take them to hospital. And having to make that call, or like in your situation, deciding that what they weren't at risk of harming themselves, it is such a tough call to make. Because if they then go on to hurt themselves, you never know that. You just need to try
guess. At the end of the day, there's very little you can do to stop someone from doing that. And I suppose it's only putting things in place and raising the, you know, people's, you know, attention, and making sure that the right people are aware of what's going on in that person's mind or how they're feeling. But I'm curious what the difference is between a bad day and bad mental
mental illness
and bad mental health. Is that right?
So everyone has a mental health, like everyone. Obviously, the majority of people tend to have good mental health most of the time. And then everyone has a bad day, whether they're like in things that can influence your mental health to go from good to bad. Could be like loneliness, stress at work, friendship problems, relationship problems, financial worries. It could literally be anything. So if that would be bad mental health, is just when you feel down, when you feel those negative emotions. And obviously that can go on for a prolonged period of time. But when it becomes a mental health illness is when those bad thoughts affect how you carry out day-to-day life, and they have a detrimental effect on your life. And obviously worst case scenario, cause you to want to end your own life. But it's when you can't see a way to carry on and you can't get on with day-to-day life, whether that is working or even like having a shower, that is when it goes into starting to be a mental health illness or problem.
So that's really important, because actually I listened to you speak earlier. I was wondering whether it was to do with how long those feelings last, but essentially what you're saying is you can have bad mental health for a long time, but as long as it's not having a significant impact on your day-to-day life and your actions, then it's quite a mental illness. Is that right?
So obviously if you have bad mental health for quite a long time, then it's never good. But the medical way of defining it, from bad mental health to mental illness, is when it starts having an effect on how you carry out your daily tasks and things like that. And that's when in my job and in my position, if I could see that people were struggling to do normal daily things, that's when I would start worrying and start thinking that there's something else going on here that I probably couldn't help them with. And that's when I'd start looking to referring to other people.
Okay. So important is talking about it, isn't it?
Because
actually it was only just the last year really where I realized for myself the importance of talking about how you feel when I'm having a bad day. You know, I'm lucky enough that I've can say that I've never had a mental illness, although people around me and people close to me have.
Yeah.
And that's always difficult to deal with, as because I struggle to connect with that person and empathize, because you need some kind of idea of what the person's going through.
Yeah.
But the difficulty with a mental illness compared to a physical illness is that you can't see it. Although, like you say, maybe you can see the result of it or the impact it's having on someone's day-to-day life. You can never really connect with that person until you've experienced that to some degree yourself. And someone who's maybe just had some prolonged period of lows, and actually you can snap out of that sometimes quite easily just by doing something positive and creating a bit of an upward spiral. Is it still just as important to talk about it with, if you have a mental illness compared to just bad mental health?
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about mental illness. I have had problems with mental illness, and it wasn't until I didn't talk about it for a long time, not even to my parents, like my family didn't know for a long time. And when I did start talking about it, so I was on reduced hours at work, and when I'd say to people, oh, I can't do that because I'm not able to work those hours, people would ask why. And when I was eventually able to open up about it, the amount of people around me that have either had mental illness problems themselves, or their partner has, or a parent or sibling or friend or someone they know, is just, it is so, so common. And I know you can look at the statistics, and the statistics are very, it's like 1 in 4 or something. But it's not until you actually start talking about it. So whether it's a bad mental health day or you've just got bad mental health or mental health problem, I think talking about feelings, I mean, it's normal to feel sad. It's normal to feel really anxious. It's normal to feel upset and things like that. It's normal to feel angry. And I think the fact people don't talk about that, it's like, on social media, for example, you would never go on someone's Instagram and see them, like a picture of them really upset or really sad or really grumpy. You'd only see them smiling or having fun and things. And I think we live in a, like at the moment, we are very much focused on the ideals and how we should be and how we should appear.
So true.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of a stigma attached to being low or people crying or you're right, because everything is so idealized and it's all about the good things that happen in people's life. And actually I think that can sometimes increase the chance of you feeling low, because I've experienced it myself, and I've had conversations with friends who have also had bad days because they've seen other people on social media having a great time. You know, you just see their highlights all the time, and actually there's no lows on there.
Yeah.
And so you could look at yourself, and I did while I was at uni. I was stuck in my room for days at a time, just, you know, doing crappy essays and thinking, well, you know, Joe Bloggs is out there in Asia traveling around the world. This person's doing skydiving, this person's doing that. And I looked back at my own life and was comparing then to now and thinking, well, I've done this cool stuff, but what am I doing now? It feels like I'm doing nothing good with my time. Yeah. And actually that can send you into a bit of a low place.
Yeah. I have come off all social media, just because I was comparing myself to other people. And although everybody knows everybody has bad days, it's hard to acknowledge that when you're looking at someone through like rose-tinted Instagram glasses and everyone's lives look amazing and so much better than yours. And I genuinely do think coming off it has made me a lot more carefree and a lot more content and happier within myself, just because I haven't got that pressure of looking and comparing myself to others or thinking, oh God, I can't afford that, or look what they're doing, I've never done that. I just am able to make aims for myself and do those for myself. And I don't need to be approved, like I don't need to put pictures up and think, oh God, I've only got like 2 likes on this. and things like that. I'm just doing things for me and for the benefit of knowing I'm going to enjoy it or it's going to feel good, rather than wanting to do it so that I can get likes on a photograph from people I barely know.
That's so good to hear. It really is, because actually I think a lot of people are tempted to ditch social media, and I say a lot of people have had bad experiences or don't particularly enjoy social media. They just do it. It's a thing that they have, and they scroll because they don't want to miss out or they want to stay up to date. And I'm not sure often how much there is to gain from social media unless you use it wisely.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you miss? Because I imagine some people out there probably have their reasons why they don't come off it.
Yeah.
You know, what are the downsides to it?
Obviously, I live hundreds of miles away from the majority of my family. So I miss seeing things like posts from my sisters, of my nieces and nephews. I've got friends in other countries, so it's like not nice not seeing their posts anymore. But I have, like, I've messaged people and said, oh, I'm not on Facebook anymore, send me pictures of the kids, or I'm not on Facebook anymore, but, like, send me photos of what you're doing in Thailand.
So there's ways of getting around
it, isn't there? I'm still, and it's almost making it more personal, because I'm not just scrolling through and, like, pressing like. I've actually reached out to those people and spoken to them and said, I hope you're good.
And likewise, they're, you know, when they speak to you, they're doing the same. They're making a physical effort to contact you and send you pictures because they're thinking about you or they want you to be involved still.
Yeah, so I think it's much nicer. And, yeah, I mean, there are things, like, there are moments of boredom where I would normally be lying on my phone scrolling through Facebook for hours. But I've started doing more things I enjoy. I've started, like, writing again. I've started exercising more. I've started going on walks and, like, spending more time with my family and friends. So it's really nice just kind of getting back into the real world and doing things I like.
And those things all strike me as some things that you would find beneficial for your mental health anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? So not only have you gone away from something that's negative
and
ditched the social media, but actually the things like the exercise, spending time with the people that care about you and people you care about, and doing rewarding things like being creative or striving towards a physical goal or something, they're all really good things for your mental health, right?
Yeah, they are, definitely. And they're things that I enjoy. Like, some people might enjoy watching TV and they might be able to get through, like, a whole TV series they've been wanting to watch for ages if they haven't got Facebook or something like that. But it's things that I used to do and things I used to enjoy and I'd kind of lost touch with. So it's nice to rediscover them again.
Definitely. And something you said earlier struck me, actually, when you talked about boredom. And that is it an emotion? It's a hard one. I would say it probably is an emotion, but that is an emotion that we try and stigmatise as well. And you think that people who are bored are just sat there twiddling their thumbs, but actually it is a normal part of daily life. And I think we are over stimulated nowadays.
Yeah.
And you always have to feel like you're doing something or you're watching or tapping something.
Yeah.
You have to have something in your hands no matter where you are, in a supermarket waiting line, or if you're in a waiting room for something, or if you're just sat down at home and you're doing nothing, you feel like you have to have that stimulation.
Yeah.
And sometimes even I've had in the past where just tapping away and scrolling through my phone is not enough, or watching the TV is not enough. Sometimes I have to have stimulation from, like, some music. I have to have notifications coming up on my phone, and if they're not, then I'm checking my phone to see why aren't they.
I think spending time on your own and being bored and being alone either with yourself or with others is so important for everyone's mental health. Like, I think when I was like really not very well, I used to distract myself by, I wouldn't acknowledge what was going on in my head because I'd be distracted by all of this stuff on my phone and make it, which would make everything in my head 10 times worse. Mm. Where now, if I'm having a bad day, I'm having got that distraction, so I'm able to acknowledge what's in my head and be like, oh God, I'm really grumpy. I'll go for a run to make me feel better, or I'll text a friend and ask if they want to go for a coffee because that'll cheer me up, or something like that.
So I wonder, did you start those activities out of boredom, or was it a choice to replace the social media?
It was probably, I didn't intentionally get rid of social media and start them at the same time, but they are activities that I used to do probably before I used social media as much as I did, so it was probably out of boredom that I started doing them again. But then obviously realized that they are so much better.
Everyone spends a lot of time on their phones.
Yeah,
and I have this app on my phone that tells me actually how many hours I've spent looking at my phone, or how many times I've opened it and and checked my phone. And it also, if I want to have a look at it, breaks down all of the different apps that I've used and how long I've spent on that.
Yeah.
And it can be quite scary actually looking through that on a daily basis, or accumulated over a week or a month, and seeing actually how much time you've spent on those things. So I imagine actually getting rid of those, like you say, that's a lot of time that you don't have that to go back to and fall back on.
Yeah.
So I imagine you naturally do just pick up things and you think, well, what am I going to do now? And they are all really positive things. It's almost like when people have addictions, that is generally because they have addictive personalities. And so I'm a bit like this, and thankfully I've not had any particularly bad healthy, you know, unhealthy habits. But someone who, say, has gone from smoking, quit smoking, often ends up picking up something like exercise and becoming addicted to that instead.
Yeah.
Is that something that you can...
Yeah, I probably have got quite an addictive personality. But I think I've been luckily been able to acknowledge that. So when I make sure, I'm quite a big writer. So when I feel like I am getting too into something, I'll write it down. So like if I'm exercising daily, then I'd write down how often I do it and make sure I'm not going over the top, just because I know what my limits are. But yeah, it is something that's kind of interesting.
When you're writing things down then, do you have a journal that you do every day, or is it that you write lists, or do you have a special pad where you just write down what's in your head? How does that,
how's
that working for you?
I've got so many. I write about like everything. So I've got a blog which I write things that just kind of come to me. So that, whether that's poetry or just things I've read about and feel quite passionate about. I've written about mental health before. So that's just kind of things that I want to get out. I've got a notebook which is very personal and things that I don't really share with anyone, and that's kind of for if I'm ever having a bad day, to kind of, or if I'm overthinking things too much, that's to kind of like get out of my head. And I find that process quite therapeutic, so that it's out of my head, I've acknowledged it, and then I can look at if it can be solved, if it can be solved, how, and if it can't be, then it's at least it's out of my head, so that's it dealt with. And then I'm big on lists, so I have like about 20 to-do lists on the go. I write down what exercise I do and things like that, just to kind of keep a record of it, just so I know what I've been doing.
So you're someone who likes to challenge yourself anyway. And I know that in the past you've done things like Dry January, and we've talked about this the last couple of days, where you you've done, you usually do a dry month where you're not drinking alcohol. And
yeah.
actually something that's quite impressive actually is this month you're not drinking anything but water.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that's going and what kind of motivated you to try that?
I think this is the first day where I've not been really tired and grumpy because I've missed coffee so much. But I'm starting to feel, like I say, today's probably the first day where I've actually started to feel the benefits. But again...
What day?
Eight, I think.
Eight into it now, I suppose.
And it's the first day also that I haven't like walked to the fridge to get something other than water out by accident and then have put it back. But
have you messed up at all yet?
No.
Not even one sip?
No, I haven't had one. I've smelt. So like in the morning I have warm water with lemon in. And I smell like, and my mum has coffee, so I can like smell her coffee as I'm drinking my warm water and lemon just to try and get my fix.
Coffee in the morning smells amazing anyway. Yeah. We had a friend at uni who would make fresh coffee on a hob with like a one of those little either cafetiere or pergola or something, and it would fill the whole house with fresh coffee. And back then I wasn't a huge fan of coffee anyway, but the smell still smelled amazing.
Yeah.
So that's what you miss the most, I take it.
Yeah. Well, I think because I was so tired, I probably drank about 6, if not more, coffees a day. I drank a lot of coffee. So
that's quite a lot of coffee.
Yeah, but I didn't really realise how much I drank because it was such a habit until the first when I couldn't drink it. And then I was just really tired. And today I've felt less tired. And I've kind of felt more energised in things, which is good. And obviously that's without coffee. So hopefully by the end of the month, I won't be drinking 6 coffees a day anymore.
I'm really interested to follow your progress on this one and see how you get on. Because a couple of days ago, you said like you were very tired and you weren't enjoying it that much and you were missing things. But mm-hmm. it already sounds like it's starting to pick up. And I'm sure it's only going to get easier and easier. And I'm curious to find out when February arrives what your experiences are and what changes you will make based on this month. Are there anything else, any other challenges in 2019, any lists of things you want to achieve?
I want to go on a trip on my own because I've never done that, so I want to go
a holiday.
So I want to go somewhere on my own. I am going to take Pip, friend, to meet my family up north.
Episode 7.
Yeah.
Pippa Cummins. Sorry, carry on.
I am going to do a running event, but I'm not like labelled how big it's going to be. So it might be another half marathon
like
or might
ultra?
Just be a 5K. No.
Maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so running, travelling, being a bit alone and stuff like that.
Yeah,
that's cool. I really do think traveling by yourself is so important, and actually it's only since I've been traveling alone, and I've done it 3 trips now. The first trip was really hard and I didn't really know how to spend time by myself, and I tried to distract myself quite a lot and was looking at social media while I was away and wasn't really absorbing it all because I was trying to disguise the fact that I felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then the second trip, it got a little bit easier. And then the third trip, I actually started to really enjoy just the freedom that it gives you of being in a foreign place or even, you know, just somewhere that's not home.
Yeah.
And knowing that you can go wherever you like, whenever you like, you can eat when you want, and all those things is brilliant. And actually, as someone who's moved out fairly recently and started living by myself, I don't think it would have been nearly as easy if I hadn't done those trips and started to get a bit more comfortable being alone.
Yeah.
How do you feel as someone who's maybe, you know, got a lot going on in your head at times?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about being by yourself with those thoughts?
I think 6 months ago it probably wouldn't have been a good idea, but I think I am in a much better place now, and I'm able to acknowledge when I'm not in a good place and get the help I need, whether that be go to the doctors or just verbalise it to a friend or a parent and just say, I'm having a really rubbish day, just so they know. And I've got like quite a lot of, when I do have bad days, there are routines and patterns I fall into.
Thing that triggers, or are they just things you fall back on?
So things that trigger me, and then bad and healthy habits relating to previous mental illnesses I've had. Things that I don't even really suffer with anymore, but still have bad habits from that. But I've got friends now that can almost identify when those are going to come.
Okay.
And so
got quite a good network. Yeah,
and they put things in place to make sure that I can't fall in and do into bad habits and do bad or silly things again, which is like good to have.
Which again must be one of the other reasons why it's so important to talk about it, because then other people know how to help you better, right?
And I think one of the important things, like when I was really unwell, in my head, everyone knew. So I had like quite a lot of like social anxiety and social paranoia. So in my head, everyone knew what was going on in my head, and everyone knew when I was having a bad day.
So you thought that everyone knew.
Yeah, and I thought it was just so obvious that I wasn't very well. So then actually talking about it and people being like, I don't get what you mean, or what, why do you feel that way, or when does this happen, and things like that. I think it's really important if you do have bad days that you probably hide it a lot better than you think you do. Because I just assumed like even like my best friends or my parents would know, who I spend a lot of time with, but they had no idea. They didn't know half of the things that were going on in my head, let alone half of the things I was actually doing. And it's just crazy how different you perceive things when you're not, when you're in that place, to how the rest of the world sees it. It's almost like you're living in your own little bubble, and it's all, but it, to you, it's real. So I think talking about it is very important and almost always has positive.
It would certainly help myself, like I say, as someone who hasn't had a lot of experience with it, or even gained a lot of knowledge from the people who've had mental illnesses around me. I definitely appreciate people talking about it more, because it was going to help me to support them and know how to be a better friend or a better family member, or just a better person in general.
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, that one in four people is a statistic. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people out there now that have suffered or are suffering. And so chances are I'm going to come across it a lot more in life, whether it's through my work or through friends and family. Yeah. So it is an important thing for us to be aware of and how to deal with. It's interesting, actually, the link between physical health and mental health. That's always something that I find curious, because actually it didn't take long for me to see that people who have bad physical health often have bad mental health as a result. And likewise, there is also a link where people have bad physical health because of their mental illnesses.
Yeah.
And actually, something that you were saying, I'm not quite sure which bit of it it was, but I think it was when you were talking about sort of the coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I've dealt with people with physical illness in physiotherapy, you realise actually how good the body is at just coping and cracking on and finding compensatory methods to carry on and almost hide the fact that something isn't right in the body. And actually it sounds fairly similar in the way you talked about it with the habits that you had and things that you fell back on, where you knew that some part of you in your head wasn't in the right place, but you had those distractions or those habits that you were going to because they were easier to do maybe than to face the reality of it.
Yeah.
And that's something that, I don't know if you follow it, but I think that's what I mean in terms of like the links between physical and mental health?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. I think people with bad physical health statistically have worse mental health. But then definitely when your mental health is bad, your motivation and reasons for obtaining good physical health are, you can't see those and you can't access them, and therefore your physical health does get worse. So I think there is definitely a link, 100%. Just the same way, like with mental health as well, if you actively don't look after your mental health, then it's going to get bad. So like doing things you enjoy, being okay on your own and things like that, I think it's just important to look after yourself in general, and then your mental health will hopefully be good. And if it's not, that's when it is a problem.
So I'm aware of the approaches that the health aspect of things has taken in terms of trying to tackle mental illness, in terms of encouraging exercise or meditation and talking about it, psychological help. Other than talking, has there been a specific method that has helped you the most, or that you think is the most helpful?
I think talking was definitely the first stage. So kind of getting the courage up to not only admitting that I wasn't well, but then talking to a professional about it. And then I think kind of from then it went to acknowledging things within myself. So now I'd say, although I medically still have mental health problems and they probably won't ever go away, I have good mental health, and the medical professionals around me agree with that. So I think it's important to realise that although you can have mental health problems, you can still have good mental health. And I think realising that, and I think when you get told you have a mental health problem, like that felt like the worst day in the world for me, because I felt like I've got this illness, and in my head it was something that I couldn't see, and it meant like I wasn't one of those people, and I had this whole idea in my head of what people with mental health problems look like or were like, and I wasn't one of those. So I think realizing that I can still have good days, and I can still be a functional adult, and I can still go to work and do everything I love, and I'm not going to be the person I was when I got diagnosed, was like the biggest thing that helped me.
So you said that it was a hard thing to hear, and it was really terrible day for you when you heard that. Was that something you accepted at the time? You were told that you had a mental illness, and you didn't want to hear it, but you accepted it? Or was it something that you pretended wasn't happening and you weren't one of those people?
I kind of knew, obviously I'd been told, so I knew it was there, but my mental health continued to be quite bad for like lots of months following. And it wasn't until it got to the point where, I'm really lucky, and my doctors are amazing, and I see my doctor every 2 weeks just to kind of keep up to date and keep in touch, which is obviously the NHS and things, that's a whole other story, but I'm really, really lucky with all the support I've had with my mental health. So I got diagnosed, and I continued to see my doctor every 2 weeks, and then I got to a point where I just wasn't okay, and I kind of acknowledged myself I wasn't okay. So it wasn't other people telling me that I should seek help. It was me realizing it, and my doctor had seen a massive decline in my mental health. And I got referred to like a crisis team and things like that. And that's when my doctor had to go above my head and tell my parents about things. And I think that was the point that I acknowledged it. And that was although that was probably just as bad as the first diagnosis, I think that was like a massive, that was probably the best day so far, because that was, although it was a massive low point for me in my health, it kind of turned things around and I was able to acknowledge that I wasn't okay. But then I think as soon as I acknowledged that, I was able to understand I could get better.
Yeah. And it's a shame often that these things take a crisis, isn't it?
Yeah.
To actually start to unravel and improve. But actually, it tends to be the way so many times where it takes a really significant event to happen before people realise something's not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, you probably use those habits or distractions to just pretend that everything is okay. Thank you so much, by the way, for opening up.
That's okay. It's
not an easy thing to talk about, and especially in this setting. So I appreciate how open you've been, and I've certainly benefited a lot from it in terms of just being a bit more aware of what's going on for people with mental illness, as well as being aware of how you're doing and what your mental illness has been. Yeah. And actually, I'll be honest, for up until very recently, I had no idea that you even had a mental illness.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show that actually the power of talking about these things has brought us to this point where I've gained a lot from it, and I hope that you continue to gain a lot from talking about these things. And I know that you've got your blog and that seems to be going quite well for you, and hopefully that helps you to continue to reach out to other people and share your story with them too. So thank you, really. I think is what I want
to
say.
Thank you for having me.
It's been inspirational. You inspire me in lots of different ways with the journey you've gone on with your studies and going and working in a deaf school and actually being an advocate for them and for that type of school and how brilliant your school is as well. I think you sing a lot of their praises.
Yeah.
But you're also inspirational in the way that you've talked about these things in such an open way tonight. So thank you so much for coming on. I hope everyone has enjoyed listening to today's episode. Thank you very much, Will, for recording as always, and we will see you all on the next episode. Take care.